Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning, Brent. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Good. For our viewers, let's introduce ourselves quickly. I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm the executive editor of the American Prospect magazine.
And I'm Brent Lindsay. I'm vice president for research at the Cato Institute.
Okay, terrific. Good to talk to you.
Good. Nice chatting with you again. So we're just days away from Election Day.
I know. I can't wait.
Do you believe any of this polls tightening stuff? What's going on?
I think you probably have to assume that polls will tighten a little bit, you know, but I don't think anything significant. I think that I kind of believe the cake was baked during that week of the financial crisis and McCain's kind of fumbling around, which really has had an interesting effect on a lot of the people, a lot of the Republicans, for example, who turned around and endorsed Obama.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's political scientists who think that presidential elections are actually pretty simple affairs, and that by and large they turn on how the economy is doing, and when it's not doing so well, the incumbent party suffers. When it is doing well, the incumbent party tends to cruise. Every once in a while, there's some little complication, like the economy could be doing well, but you're having an unpopular war, or the economy could be doing well, but you've got some big scandal. But by and large, right. The cake was certainly in the oven and turning golden brown against the Republicans long ago. This most recent economic meltdown and McCain's the way he comported himself during it that really did have to finish it off, didn't it?
Right. I mean, McCain was a candidate who at least in theory could have run the kind of campaign where he was actually different from the incumbent party at the same time that he reflected some of the things that people liked about the incumbent party. So I don't think the cake was necessarily baked, 6 months ago, and it certainly wasn't necessarily baked against a, you know, inexperienced
right.
African American senator and so forth. I mean, I'd like to think that there are a few kind of what ifs still that might have changed things, but I think most of those have passed.
No, I would say if to the extent that actions during this campaign have doomed McCain, and we're both assuming he's doomed. We're both assuming that Obama is going to win fairly comfortably next week. Then I would say first the Palin nomination, which I think simultaneously ended his efforts to portray himself as a different kind of Republican, and instead threw him into a very Rovian style campaign against effete elites.
Right.
And on behalf of real pro America, right. And then secondly the when the bottom dropped out of the financial sector, and which just that was going to be bad news in any event. And then I felt that McCain's kind of erratic and strange behavior during that when he was suspending and unsuspending his campaign reinforced the impulsive, erratic decision to choose Palin. So put those
right.
Double whammy together, on top of which he then ran a very sort of, campaign in the style of Lee Atwater and Karl Rove. The result was pretty much
right.
Inevitable.
Right. I mean, the poor guy I'm not a McCain fan and never have been, but I begin to feel a certain amount of sympathy for him. I mean, he got handed a generic campaign as somebody who's a very non-generic he doesn't deserve a generic campaign. He deserves a campaign that reflects something about John McCain. And I think he was very poorly served in that respect, although maybe the McCain-type campaign wouldn't have worked either.
On the one hand, you get this feeling of, like the line in Godfather 3, every time I feel I've gotten free, they're dragging me back in. And you feel this guy just get tugged in by the gravitational pull of this style of Republican politics. On the other hand, it felt like he tried a high-minded, lofty campaign during the time after he'd sewed up the nomination, and he was doing a more sort of McCain-style campaign, and he was absolutely being ignored by the press, and he wasn't getting anywhere, and it was really only...
What period do you think?
Oh, you know, when he was going to Selma and to,
right,
and to Louisiana and doing that kind of thing.
Right.
Then
I think that viewpoint was reflected in that John Heilman story in New York Magazine a couple weeks ago about how, you know, I guess Steve Schmidt or one of those people saying, you know, we tried that, nothing happened with it. And I think they believe it. I mean, I think it's deep in McCain. I think McCain deeply believes that if only they'd been able to do these town meetings jointly with Obama, everything would have been completely different. As if he had no active choice in the kind of campaign that he...
No, of course. So, of course, he chose it, and I think he chose it because he wasn't getting any kind of buzz or excitement or enthusiasm at all beforehand. Right. It wasn't until he selected Palin that there was really any enthusiasm, grassroots enthusiasm, about his campaign at all. Unfortunately, that was a Faustian bargain. It got him the base, and it alienated everybody else.
Right, right. And you could foresee that happening. I mean, I have to say I've defended the Palin choice. I'll keep defending the Palin choice in only one respect, which was he had to find some way to reach into the future of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you reach into the future of the Republican Party, there are not a lot of options that you have. You know, it's Governor Pawlenty, it's Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana.
Right.
You know, they were talking about Eric Cantor, who's a third-term member of Congress from Virginia.
Yeah.
You know, if you array all those, you might as well pick the woman, you know, out of all those relatively inexperienced and fresh faces. But you had to find a way to do that. I think if they'd known more about her, they would have said, well, not her either. But
right. So, yeah, I mean, I agree that politically he needed to do something dramatic if he was going to have any hope of being competitive in the fall, and that he needed somebody that would reinforce his whole, you know, maverick shtick,
right.
And that looked like a break from Bush. Right. But substantively, he needed to choose somebody who knew something about public policy and who was capable of being, you know, of doing things candidates do, like talk to the press.
Right.
And so to choose someone who you know, wasn't really, you know, up to it, and to choose that person without any, after having, you know, had months and months and months of being the presumptive nominee, and to choose somebody basically on whim without really having delved into whether this person was ready for the spotlight or not, just to me really was indicative of my darkest fears about a McCain presidency, which is that the guy just does not seem to me like a competent executive who's capable of making reasoned decisions based on sound decision-making procedures. He's impulsive, and it showed with what he got, and then what he got was, you know, it perhaps was an effort to look to some kind of post-Bush future of the Republican Party, some fresh-faced reformer who isn't part of the past, but in fact, to the extent that Sarah Palin has worked, she has worked as a complete throwback, to, you know, going all the way back to kind of McCarthyite, sort of just the seething resentment of Eastern elites by the good, pure folks in the heartland. That's been a, you know, a strain of cultural populism in the right for a long time. Nixon certainly made use of it. Reagan fused it with a libertarian economic message and with a different take on the Cold War. But it's sort of all that's left, and it's not very future oriented. Let's just put it that way.
Right, right. But you know, in a sense, it's not just that Sarah Palin did that. McCain has done it every bit as much, and it's never been very much of his political persona.
No.
You know, I mean, both of them chose this path of kind of identity politics. I mean, I wrote about this. I have to say, the article that I wrote, I guess, last year or the beginning of this year about identity politics and the future of the Republican Party or the conservative movement, so it seemed to me pretty, if I can brag a little bit, it seemed kind of prescient. I mean, it's kind of like all the substance that was always the sort of the frosting on the cake of Bush and so forth, and now it's all there is.
Yes,
all the underlying stuff of it. I mean, used to have substantive arguments about, say, welfare policy. And some people would, you know, some liberals would get upset and say, oh, this welfare policy, it's just a code for, you know, dog whistle for talking about shiftless African-American
people, right,
whatever. But underneath it, there was an actual policy, which is called welfare policy, and it didn't work very well, and you need to fix it, and you know, and eventually Democrats fixed it, and so that issue wasn't there anymore. And now you sort of don't have anything left except for this thing called socialism or redistributing the wealth.
Yeah, so
it doesn't really relate to much, which the only policy underlying that is something like the earned income tax credit, which people like John McCain have always supported. So
no, so that's it, I mean, that's right. I think it's that the, you know, post-war conservative movement is out of gas, and one of the main reasons it's out of gas is that it's a victim of its own successes. It campaigned for it took advantage of fears of escalating crime rates during the 60s and 70s, and and in fact it won that debate. Now both Democrats and Republicans are you know, pretty tough on crime, and Democrats don't allow themselves to be outflanked on that issue anymore. And and for whatever reasons, we're not entirely sure, crime rates started plummeting in the 90s, and so the issue has lost its salience. Secondly, Republicans, rose to power based on lousy economic performance in the 70s and based on one aspect of the inflationary 70s bracket creep, which pushed everybody's tax burdens up substantially over the course of that decade. And so they won on tax cutting, and they've cut taxes so that, I don't know, it's something like a third or more of Americans don't even pay income taxes at all.
Those lucky duckies. I just went back and read that editorial from the Wall Street Journal in 2002.
So the appeal of the tax cutting issue is clearly diminishing because so much was accomplished.
Sure.
And then finally, of course, they campaigned, based on a more vigorous American posture during the Cold War, and then we won the Cold War, and then we tried a vigorous posture post 9/11, and it blew up in our faces. So, so that issue's gone, partially gone because of a victory in the Cold War, and then on the basis of a misguided attempt to replay Cold War attitudes in the post 9/11 setting. So they're out of stuff, right? And all they've got left is this this silent majority shtick, which clearly plays and will generate enthusiastic crowds and can turn the people who tap into that into demagogic rock stars. But that's a 40% strategy, I'm afraid.
Right. Oh, absolutely, at best. And then there will be this confrontation. It'll be interesting to, as a libertarian, I guess you don't really view yourself as part of that coming conversation about the future of the conservative coalition.
No. I've said this a few times that until the past few years, although I've always throughout my adult life considered myself a libertarian and therefore neither a liberal nor a conservative, I frankly, as a matter of practical politics, considered myself a conservative sympathizer. I thought that on balance, they were right on economics, and I was a Cold War hawk, so I thought they were right on foreign policy. I didn't like the religious rights social agenda, but I thought it mostly got lip service. So for me, it was pretty easy to believe that the best practical hopes for my kind of thinking to get into power and have influence was if conservative Republicans won office. Then, the experience of having conservative Republicans capture the House and Senate and White House and then seeing what happens to it was quite disillusioning. So I don't see it'll be very interesting to see what happens to the right after this election, but right now, I'm not really seeing myself as part of that conversation. I'm a very interested spectator, right now, I'd rather spend my time arguing with good, sensible liberals like yourself about economics than having culture wars with the right over Darwin and stem cells and Mexicans.
Well, I don't blame you. I don't blame you. That's the kind of argument I'd rather have you having too. I'm just curious, among sort of not just you, but among kind of libertarians like yourself who are not necessarily going to vote for Bob Barr or Ron Paul, or even if they are, what's the level of comfort with the idea of an Obama presidency among libertarians?
Oh, I think you put five libertarians in a room, you've got 7 or 8 points of view. Right. So I don't know how much you can generalize. I think that a lot of it depends on how you weight issues and what's of greatest concern to you. People who are most focused on economic policy, and that's really what they're passionate about, are really worried about an Obama presidency and strong Democratic majorities in both houses, because the policy positions that these folks are endorsing are not ones that that we like at all. If, on the other hand, your sort of primary focus is on foreign policy or on civil liberties, then it seems so clear that that Obama is the lesser of two evils that that you're just that it's not a hard choice to think that Obama is preferable, even if you think that there's going to be tough sledding on the economic policy front. I can really only speak for myself. I have come to the conclusion that there is much less difference on economic policy between Republicans and Democrats than there used to be. I don't see much fiscal restraint. I don't see much sort of sound economic policy making coming out of the Republicans. I think their advantage there has really diminished or evaporated. And I'm quite rueful about having supported the Iraq War and having trusted the Republicans to be stewards of foreign policy. So for me, it's not a tough call to think that Obama is the lesser of two evils. On the other hand, when it comes to economic policies, on trade policies, on pushing the labor agenda, on card check legislation, on tax policy generally, on the idea that we're going to have some federally engineered green economy renaissance, all of that stuff, I don't buy into at all. And so I can't really sum it up in any enthusiasm for an Obama administration. I think there's going to be some missteps and some policy errors, and that I'm going to find myself in the opposition most of the time.
Okay, that's always a comfortable position to be in. No, I mean, it's interesting to me because I'm so struck by how many moderate to even conservative Republicans have become more comfortable with Obama, including even some of the neoconservatives.
Yep.
Sometimes some of them may be, you know, when somebody like Ken Edelman endorses Obama, there's probably some battle with McCain in the past there, or, you know, something that we don't know about. But it's interesting to me, and I haven't sort of seen that many people who are clearly libertarians come into that camp. And it's interesting to me because I think Obama's viewpoint, aside, leaving aside specific policies and on taxes, as far as I'm concerned, I just hate the idea that we're cutting off that we're exempting everybody below $250,000. As a liberal, my view is, you know, if somebody makes $80,000 purely off capital gains, they ought to pay the same amount of tax as somebody who makes $80,000, working. But that's where we are. It seems to be a very conservative approach to taxes. Still grounded in the view that is still the third rail of
yeah. So let's get to that in a second, because I want to talk about the whole spreading the wealth thing.
Okay,
but first I do want to talk about this very interesting fissure in the right, and it seems to me that Palin is key to what's going on. That you see people. I mean, it's shocking to see some of the people who have endorsed Obama. Colin Powell, obviously, Edelman, you mentioned. I would say two more libertarian people Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, and then also someone who's not as well known, but to me is a fairly prominent guy, Charles Fried, who's a Harvard law professor, was Solicitor General under Reagan, and he's endorsed. I think he was actually involved in the McCain campaign in the primaries.
He was on he was on like the legal policy advisory board.
Yeah, but so he was, you know, an official McCain supporter, and he's bailed. And in all of these people, a common denominator, if not the common denominator, is just horror at the Palin nomination.
Right, right. Which in a way is an interesting. it's an interesting position for Obama to be in, because you have some portion of your support comes from people who are not, they're not moving to you because of policy so much as shock at the decision-making process of John McCain.
Yes.
No, you know, I mean, there's a certain amount of policy differential with where the McCain campaign has been, but it's also the period from the, you know, the Palin nomination through his behavior in the economic, in the financial bailout, all reveal, you know, something that anybody who hung around the Senate enough to watch John McCain in action knew about.
Yes.
It was just a very, you know, impulsive, often driven by anger, very irresponsible way of making decisions, which, you know, it's one of the curses of the Senate, and one of the reasons one wants to be wary of electing senators to the presidency, is that that kind of thing has very little cost in the U.S. Senate. You know, it kind of, it's kind of, you can get away with a
sure.
lot of stuff, and it actually even has some payoff. But you know, in an executive role, it's not what you want.
No, and it's not. I think it's very importantly relevant to McCain's capacity as an executive, but it's also, the Palin nomination is very relevant to the sort of soul of the Republican Party and what it stands for, and
right.
and that has, that symbolism has sent a number of you know, the effete intellectual elitist types are recoiling in horror, because
right.
it's they were attracted to conservatism because it was a movement of ideas, insurgent ideas during the 70s about the role of government in the economy that that at the time did not have mainstream favor, but had very smart people lined up in favor of them. And to feel like you're now in a movement that just sort of celebrates anti-intellectualism and just embraces the right's reputation as the stupid party with pride, that's discouraging, and it's completely alienating, and I think
right.
it's sending
right.
these people who are, you know, who are the folks who had been integral to conservatism's success as a movement ideas, it's sending them running for the hills.
Sure. But then, and then you're going to have an Obama elected with the support of these people, but you're not going to have, that thing will be gone.
It's, right, that, no, longer, that's right. So
it's
that's
no longer the, about Palin, and it'll be an interesting coalition that you have. It doesn't really matter, I guess, but.
Yeah, so that goes to what, yeah. if McCain, if Obama does win, you know, going away next week, or just wins with a, you know, a comfortable mm-hmm. popular majority and a big electoral majority, of course, folks on the left are going to be incredibly enthusiastic and starry-eyed and giddy about the idea that they have a mandate for some gigantic lurch to the left. I'm quite skeptical of that, because I feel like a lot of Obama support is based generally on disgust with Republican misrule rather than enthusiasm
right.
for Democratic policy ideas, and then specifically
right.
about this specific campaign, what a turnoff it is to folks in the middle of the political spectrum, and so there's definitely an anti-Republican mandate, but that doesn't do Obama much good if his goal is to you know, be the Democratic Reagan or to install some new Deal as some folks are getting carried away and talking about.
Right.
To me, that doesn't seem like his personality to begin with, and even if it were, I don't see the political conditions are there for something like that to be viable.
Right. Well, that's what I've been trying. That's what I've been thinking about a lot, because I've gotten a head start on writing my post-election piece, because I would have had only about
yes.
3 days to write it. So I've decided if McCain wins, I'll just have the 3 days, but otherwise I'll get a little head start.
Yeah.
What's interesting to me is I think there's a tremendous misconception about the relationship between the election and the mandate and being able to get things done as president. I think we often think of, there's a tendency to think of, you know, the bigger the vote you get, the more power you have, and then you just exercise that power, and it depletes quickly.
Right.
You remember Bush, you know, Bush the day after the election in 2004 said, I've earned political capital and I'm going to
now
use
I'm
going it.
To spend it, right.
Which, you know, is why we've now privatized Social Security and
yes.
had comprehensive tax reform and all the things that he talked about doing in that, you know, in that moment. In fact, he had, you know, all he'd done was won an election.
Yeah.
And winning the election is actually a very small thing. People casting their vote for you against another person is kind of a small act.
It doesn't have a lot of information content in it.
It doesn't have a lot of information content. It doesn't give you a mandate for a particular policy. You earn that over a period of time. And I've always thought, you know, it's a misconception. We get fixated on the 100 days. And I think the biggest danger to the Obama presidency is going to be the gazillions of liberals around town with their, you know, and moderates, or, you know, it'll be DLC, it'll be everything. With their 100-day plans, and if he doesn't do exactly this in the first 100 days, he'll never be able to get anything done. Which to me is just ahistorical, actually. I mean,
yeah.
If you think about Reagan in 80 won the election, and then over the course of 1981 kind of got to the point where he had the mandate to do the budget and tax cuts in August.
Right.
And kind of built that mandate over. There were some terrible missteps, like on Social Security. I mean, there are times when it all but slipped away, and then they built back up to
right.
That,
and let's face and let's face it, the you know, the friendly, genial uncle reputation of Reagan, that wasn't, nobody thought that during the campaign. He was this sort of sharp edged, hawkish,
right.
scary guy to
right.
people who disagreed with him. It was,
right.
you know, one thing that was a big deal was the assassination attempt and his wonderful good humor during that.
Absolutely.
And the reservoirs of sympathy that opened up for him after that.
Right.
And so, you know, that was part of it. But even so, I would say that Reagan ran a campaign that was much more focused on policy differences than to me Obama's is. Of course, Obama has his policy positions, and they're different from Bush policies in a number of key respects, but it seems to me that what Obama has been running on has been first this kind of general, you know, just desire for something new, change, a desire for escape from the sort of toxic politics of recent years with talk about hope and transpartisan stuff, and then just the appeal of him, his biography and his personality and temperament. He's a measured,
right.
smart,
right.
thoughtful, sensible guy. And so if that's what people are voting for, just A, disgust with the status quo, and B, a sensible fellow, then that doesn't really translate into big momentum for
right.
policy specifics.
I would say two things that are exceptions to that. One, the infomercial last night, or the half hour commercial,
yep.
was extremely substantive, with the substance grounded in, you know, narrative of people's experience. I mean, it was
I don't dispute that, especially since he wrapped up the nomination, he's been focusing more and more on kind of meat and potato specific issues. I just don't think that's the source of his appeal.
Well, and the other exception I would say is that I think it remains true that the heaviest ad buys, and the ones that have had a huge impact, are the ads on healthcare policy. The ads, you know, there's some that are a straight out attack on the McCain healthcare approach, and others that are more of a contrast, and those are pretty specific substantive ads. So they are looking for a mandate for that, which is very interesting because I think the consensus. Among people who are not, you know, pure healthcare policy wonks who
yeah.
want to see it enacted, even some who are, the consensus is that you actually really are going to go pretty slow, that he's going to go pretty slow on healthcare.
Yeah,
it's interesting how much stake he's putting on a pretty big promise on a specific healthcare plan.
Yeah, I think you can make a lot of hay politically trashing the healthcare policy status quo, and Obama has certainly made hay attacking McCain's healthcare proposals, but it's just a completely different matter when you come up with your own plan and try to put it into the Washington sausage grinder.
Right.
We'll see, but yeah. But I boy, I don't picture a 100 days rush to transform America's healthcare finances.
And I think if you can, I mean, the interesting thing to me, the hallmark of the Obama campaign has always been this kind of, you know, almost unnatural patience.
Yep.
And, you know, the patience through the financial bailout, to me, like the critical act, and was when, after losing the New Hampshire primary, you know, it's an act of political tactics, but it was so crazy at the time. After they lose the New Hampshire primary, instead of pouring everything into the immediate next primary to sort of regain the momentum,
yes,
and find, you know, because insurgent candidates run on momentum.
Right.
They did something totally different, which was look at the primaries that were coming a month ahead.
Yes.
And that's when they started seeding every one of those primaries and caucuses, you know, that were months out, and understood that it was just a long game until the very end. No insurgent candidate for president had ever done that. That just wasn't the way you did it. And every time, just having that instinct for, you know, the long view,
yep,
I think will stand him very well. And to remember that, you know, while we, you know, I think there is a potential for a new deal here. I think there's a potential for a whole different economic order. But you have to, you know, the FDR's 100 days are very interesting, and a lot of emergency actions were taken, you know, were taken in the first 100 days. A lot of,
yes,
things that were unconstitutional, even now, you know,
yeah,
post-switch in time standards,
right,
were unconstitutional. I mean, the 100 days had a lot of messy stuff in it. Whereas the second New Deal is really where you started to actually really realign the relationship between the economy and the society. And even, you know, and even, I mean, LBJ understood exactly what was possible in 64, 65, and maximized what was possible, because he knew, you know, he knew every single moving piece of Congress.
Right.
But that was also, you know, again, it's 4 years after the Kennedy election.
Yes.
You know, 4 years after the election that actually was the party shift.
Yeah.
So.
No, so I think you're right that Obama's level-headedness and his deliberateness, first, are just very attractive, regardless of,
yeah,
what specific, yeah, policies he's putting forward. He just projects this calm and reasonableness that attracts people, even who disagree with him.
Right.
And then secondly, I think you're right, it could very well stand him in good stead to bide his time and wait for his moment, and so that he, mm-hmm, that, on issues where I disagree with him, he could end up being more effective in the long run simply because he's patient and waits for the correct time.
Right, right. So maybe you have a year or two left of predatory capitalism.
So, so let's
swoop in and collectivize the Cato Institute.
And spread the wealth around for everybody. So let's talk about spreading the wealth around.
I
found that it just kind of... it's like the you know, Claude Rains in Casablanca, shocked that gambling is going on in this Rick's Cafe.
shocked
that wealth is being spread around by the political process. of course, that's the whole game, isn't it? And so the idea that that, you know, amidst all of these different policies to tax Peter, to subsidize Paul, this one phrase indicates that this guy is some kind of radical socialist. Just struck me as the kind of the lamest form of right wing thinking.
Yes, I agree. I agree with that. I mean, there's very. I mean, in a way, as a matter of political tactics, what has struck me about it was that you sort of have this sense of the McCain campaign almost like laying back and saying, we're going to wait, they're going to give us something, and we're going to just be able to run with it.
Right.
And then you get some little thing, and somebody, you know, you see them in a room thinking, well, you know, if we really, like, really take this Joe the Plumber guy and we really crank this up, we'll really be able to make it a killer. But, you know, you really, I mean, life doesn't hand you those things very often.
Yeah.
When people are disciplined, and there's only so much you can, you know, maybe it deserves a mention. Maybe it's a phrase that in some ways deserves a mention if that's your policy approach. But it doesn't. You can't. You know, I saw Steve Schmidt say, you know, this redistribute the wealth line. This was a big mistake on Obama's part. He's going to really regret saying that. It's, You know,
I mean, you can.
At a certain point, you've just made way too much of it, and then it loses all power.
Right.
If it never had any.
You can try to draw the distinction that although all government policies and activist government interventions and spending initiatives have the effect of redistributing wealth, that isn't necessarily their point. That they're trying to accomplish various public objectives, and along the way, Peter gets taxed to subsidize Paul. Whereas it sounded as if Obama's point for tax policy was to redistribute wealth and to reduce inequalities, which I think it is, right? That's part of his whole tax policies is to cut against the increase in income inequality by raising taxes on people at the top and lowering them on people in the middle and the bottom.
Cut against inequality and also, reduce economic insecurity among those on the bottom.
That's right. You know? But there's a straight up ideological commitment to the idea that the equalization of incomes is a good thing, or equalization of incomes at their present level of inequality is a good thing. But again,
I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. I think you can support progressive taxation solely on the basis that wealthier people have greater ability to pay for common good.
No, that's right. So
then believing that income should be equalized.
Right. So I think that that game was given away with progressive taxation, which we've had for a long time. And in fact, my understanding is that under Bush, because of all the people being lopped off at the bottom of the tax rolls, our overall income tax system is, despite the rate cutting at the top, arguably more progressive than it was in the past, the overall scheme, because so many people dropped off at the bottom.
So that
people at the top pay a higher percentage of the total income tax burden than they used to.
Right, because they have a higher percentage of the total income.
Yeah, right, and also because people at the bottom have been excused.
Because of the 10% rate. The 10% rate helped.
It seems to me that a lot of people on the left have been arguing that the rise in income inequality is, on its own, a bad thing, that it's bad to have such highs and lows, and that that perhaps it is occurring because of salutary economic developments, globalization, technological change, but that the bottom line is still one that makes people of an egalitarian stripe concerned. And if pre-tax inequality is going up, then they don't want to see tax policy pushing in the same direction. They want to see tax policy pushing in the opposite direction. And I think Obama buys that. And that's part of what is animating his tax policy. Again, though, that's nothing terribly new. That's the whole idea behind that's something that's going on in progressive income tax rates from the get-go. And to my mind, although really sympathetic to the idea, if concern about income inequality is what's driving your policy, I think that relatively modest jiggering of the tax structure is a much better way to go about addressing those anxieties than a number of alternatives, such as protectionism or bailouts for the automakers or other sort of attempts to deal with economic anxiety by gumming up the way markets work.
Right.
I would much rather let markets work and then have some redistribution on the back end than try to do your redistribution through policies that interfere with the processes of market competition and market-based economic development.
Okay. I mean, I think we might be at more or less the same place by very different paths in a sense. I don't actually believe in income equalization as a primary goal in itself.
Right.
I think there are colleagues in the American Prospect Bank who do, aren't there? That is correct. Although I don't know, the back column of our current issues, a column by Bob Reich, who sort of argues historically that the levels of income inequality that we've seen should almost be seen as a kind of warning sign of economic instability,
right,
as they were in 1929. And I think that's actually a kind of interesting argument. I don't know what level of inequality I think is. I mean, I accept a large amount of inequality in a dynamic economy. I think it's a price you pay. I don't think you should strive to completely level the field at all. And I think what you basically have is I think there's a common interest in certain levels of certain measures of economic security, certain, you know, protection of common good, you know, national defense, a whole set of shared public goals, which we should pay for in proportion to our ability to pay, and that's kind of where I come from on progressive taxation. I will say one thing though about income inequality, and this has just been like a little bugaboo of mine.
Yeah.
You know, if you go to the McCain website, you know you can print out this thing that says like, you know, I'm Joe the Plumber. You can print out, you know, I'm Brink, the Vice President for Research.
Yes.
Don't tax me for working hard. Don't tax me for working hard. It all gets embedded in this idea that people who earn more money work harder. And I just think I just wish it were banished from public discourse. You know, I know lots of people who, well, you know, people who earn more money than I do, I know some of them work harder than I do. Some of them work a lot less hard. Nobody works harder than, you know, hotel maids and folks like that. I mean, the idea that there's any kind of correlation between how you do economically in this kind of economy and how hard you work, it just should be considered staggeringly offensive.
Yeah, it can certainly. It can certainly just end reasoned debate by appearing insulting. I mean, there is the fact that the number of full-time workers per household in the top decile is significantly larger, higher mm-hmm. than the number of full-time workers per household in the bottom decile. Mm-hmm. One factor of income inequality is that labor force participation at the bottom of society is lower than it is at the top. And it didn't used to be that way. It used to be that labor force participation at the bottom was higher than it was at the top. And so there is something going on there. But there are a lot of different things going on. One is that
at the bottom, you often can't afford to work. You know, you can't afford the child care that allows you to work, things like that.
Yes, and yet people somehow or another did it when the whole society was much poorer. So, but it's a complicated question. But to try to generalize it into our income inequality is due to the fact that some people work harder than others. That's just not helpful. I just did want to say though that a lot of this focus on inequality has, and I'm of kind of mixed minds about this issue. When it comes to inequality in terms of how unskilled workers are doing relative to more highly skilled workers and the growth of the college wage premium and the sort of stagnation of or anemic growth rates of low-skilled wages, and the fact, therefore, that a lot of Americans really aren't sharing in the opportunities that economic development is creating for others, that to me is a subject of legitimate concern. I've never been especially interested in the runaway good fortunes of the top 1%. The fact that right. people at the very top are earning dazzling and you know incredible fortunes just doesn't seem like it's you know any skin off my nose or a matter of public concern. But it has been a matter of public concern on the left, and it's a good tag for, or a good sort of way to hype and showcase income inequality is to focus on, well, the top 1% earned this amount in the 70s and now they earn this amount today. Right. What I think we might be seeing, though, is that probably a good chunk of the top 1%'s heady gains in recent years are about to go bye-bye. So, or have just gone bye-bye over the last couple of months. It will be interesting to see what the stats look like in a year or two's time as to what percentage of total income the top 1% account for after this bust.
Right. And I think the challenge, and I kind of come from the same viewpoint. I don't particularly care about the top 1%, particularly because I've I've been financially dependent on those on such people for much of my adult life. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but no, in general, I mean, I think the opportunity to for people to make that kind of money is part of a dynamic economy, and some of it is unproductive and led to the kind of, you know, the creation of bizarre financial instruments and so forth that had nothing to do with actual wealth creation. But in general, it's not nearly as important to me as what's that basic level of opportunity for, you know, high school graduate.
Yeah.
You know, who wants to be able to build a middle class lifestyle. All the people that you know you saw in that Obama ad last night. The challenge is that nobody's, you know, there's no easy answer to that, and it's not redistribution through tax policy.
Right.
You know, it's very.
That's right.
I mean, that's not even where the earned income tax credit is going or anything like that. You can reduce those people's taxes a little bit.
Right,
that's a good thing, but actually figuring out how you're going to recreate the kind of economy that creates those opportunities is a huge challenge, and again, it's not a first 100 days challenge.
Right, and so that's right. If this, you know, coming recession ends up wiping out people in the at the very top and flattening the income distribution some, you know, who did that help? What was... That, so the idea that those numbers are telling us something significant about the things we really care about, which is whether people have good opportunities to flourish and develop, that's what we ought to be focusing on.
And in the late 90s, when you had close to a full employment economy, you also had a lot of income inequality because you had, you know, you really did have some boom, particularly localized, you know, huge
yes.
forces being there. That is sometimes something that happens when you have. When you actually have a full employment economy,
yes,
so you don't necessarily begrudge.
That's right, people do well. That's good. So yeah, but you know, going all the way back now to the spread the wealth stuff, it's just to me, it's a symptom of how hysterical our policy debate has gotten. That you know, a 35% top tax rate is social Darwinism, and a 39% top tax rate is socialism. That's
right.
That's a pretty narrow band for
right. Well, I saw E.J. Dionne from the Washington Post columnist yesterday, who said that a friend to his left had said to him earlier in the week that we're going to have an election that's a referendum on socialism, and socialism is going to win.
Well, yeah, that kind of socialism, the idea of an activist government.
That is socialism with a human face.
Yeah, but you know, an activist government that's got his fingers in everything, you know, we've had that kind of system for a long time. I don't see any real meaningful ideological mandate coming next Tuesday at all.
Right.
It is certainly an open possibility that Obama, through marshaling the resources he has and taking advantage of events as they come down the pike, could steer the country into, you know, new policy directions that rebalance the respective roles of government and the private sector in important dimensions. I think we're coming close to our end of our time here, and we were going to talk more about the economy, but we don't have too much time to do that. But I would just say that the idea that there is going to be some sort of radical shift, or that this era of free markets is coming to an end, seems to me to be a fairly hysterical overgeneralization. That much of the economic deregulation that occurred in the 70s and 80s, where we just pretty much got rid of wholesale, fairly pervasive controls on prices and controls on who was allowed to compete in critical sectors of the economy, in transportation, in energy, in finance, in telecommunications. So we had the, you know, Ma Bell monopoly. We had interest rate caps and branch banking restrictions, so the banking industry was main, you know, was sort of suppressed at a very low level of development. Mm-hmm. We had,
although some of those,
you know,
are looking a little,
yeah,
good.
We had a little bit, yeah, we had, but that, you know, that system blew up with the SNL crisis,
yeah.
So it got blown up by inflation. So But, you know, trucking regulation and railroad regulation and airline regulation, none of that's coming back. We are in a market-based entrepreneurial system that we depend upon to produce wealth in this country, and I think it clearly works better than one in which government regulators are telling people what prices to charge and are, you know, have to give permission to people to enter into industries. So, right. So the big swath of deregulation, I think, was a good thing, and it is not being revisited. The financial sector is a sector that remains heavily regulated. Clearly, in retrospect, not well regulated, but it is not a reign of cowboy laissez-faire. It is a complex institutional mix of markets and government controls, and it is, I think, clear in retrospect that mix has led to disastrous outcomes, and we need to think about what the appropriate rules are going forward. But that seems to me to be a pretty technical question, not some sort of grand ideological revelation.
Right, and I think that's sort of, in a way, where we are now is back to the world of, I was referred to the speech that John Kennedy gave in 1962 at the Yale commencement, where he said, you know, our problems are not grand ideological fights; they're technical problems to be worked out technically. And that seems almost where we are with the economy right now. I'm staggered at the consensus on the sort of center left consensus, which certainly Obama represents well, that of the kind of modified Chicago school of the kind of new era Chicago school of economics of people like Austin Goolsbee or Cass Sunstein and so forth, which is a kind of respect for markets with the lessons of behavioral economics kind of worked into it, without necessarily all the rational expectations, and that allows you to think more technically about, you know, why small differences can have huge impacts on the outcome. And I think the mix of regulated and deregulated can be incredibly dangerous, where people are really always trying to play between those two things.
Yes.
And get the protection and insurance of the regulated side, as we're seeing with Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley becoming bank holding companies and moving over to the regulated side, essentially, but sort of playing off between the unlimited potential of the unregulated side and the protections of the regulated side. All the trouble occurs on those margins.
Right, so that's right. So,
technical problem.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, so, beyond my ability to say more than just state that.
Yeah, this is not.
I hope there's some people who know how to manage it well.
Yeah, this is not my field, but in this system of complex rules, you just inevitably have regulatory arbitrage, right, where folks try to get around the rules cleverly, and yet you can't just say, well, we have to regulate, because an inevitable consequence is that you're going to have these unintended responses to the regulation.
Right.
And then you can't just say, in a mixed system like this, you can't just say that if you're a free market guy like I am, you can't just say that every deregulation, every relaxation of rules at the margin is good, because what it could end up doing is, allowing market signals to transmit more clearly, it could be allowing government distortions to be amplified by deregulating.
Right, right. Or market distortions. I mean, all kinds of distortions.
You're
creating whatever, every time you do that, you're moving the line between regulated and deregulated, and that line has consequences.
So I agree with you that the sort of informed opinion within the Democratic Party on economics, when they're not courting union votes, has shifted dramatically in a direction that I find congenial. What might be interesting in the future is if more refugees from the right, like myself, wash up on the shores of Democratic Party Island, and we want to get involved, what kind of interesting intramural disputes about that continue to push in a more pro-market and less reflexively government's always the answer kind of approach, and that's
right.
that to me what the whole libertarian thing is all about is As I said at the outset of this, I'd rather argue economics with liberals than basic cultural values with the right these days.
Well, we better have bigger, more vigorous arguments, as enjoyable as it is. But yeah, I actually think part of that is for the libertarians to also recognize just how much the liberal consensus has shifted.
No, yes, that's right.
Sometimes I feel a little bit like you're chasing after straw men from the, early 90s.
I think it has shifted in important ways, and that's why I have entertained the idea of engagement between people like me and people like you.
Okay, good.
Nice
we'll
engaging with you, and we'll have much more to talk about in coming months. But
okay,
this was a fun chat.
Okay, thanks, Frank.
Look forward to doing it again. All right, bye-bye.
Take care, bye.